Hello and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. This episode, I'm speaking with Paul Benson. You may be familiar with Paul for a few reasons. Paul has the successful podcast Financial Autonomy. Be sure to check it out if you haven't already. And he's also released a book, also called Financial Autonomy, a great read too. And on top of that, he's a qualified financial advisor based in Melbourne. As 2020 is a year full of uncertainty, much of which is the financial uncertainty we're experiencing in many ways, I thought an interesting time to get Paul on and speak with him about the conversations he's having with his clients. We cover a lot of topics, from the importance of goal setting and the role of budgets in achieving your goal, to investor psychology and the need to protect yourself from being your own worst enemy at times. The usual disclosures: this episode is just for informational purposes only and does not qualify as investment or financial advice. People may hold positions in the companies discussed, and I work for Six Park, and the views and opinions expressed in this episode are those of mine and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or position of Six Park. And before we jump into the conversation, apologies as during the recording there are a couple of minor tech glitches. Paul and I are both based in Victoria, and with the amount of Zoom meetings taking up bandwidth on servers, internet speeds aren't always reliable. The issue was at my end, but I want to give a special mention to my kids who took one for the team and they stopped streaming Paw Patrol so their dad could get all the bandwidth at home. So to be fair, they weren't on board with the call straight away, but we got there. So thank you, kids. If you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to this podcast, give it a rating, or even tell a friend. I appreciate it. It all helps. Okay. Enough of a run-up. With no further ado, my name is Ted Richards. You're listening to The Richards Report. And here is my discussion with Paul Benson.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Paul, welcome to the Richards Report podcast.
Hey, hello, Ted. Thanks for having me along.
All right. Now, Paul, you're a financial advisor, a fellow podcaster, and an author. So there's a lot I want to cover in this discussion. And we've spoken quite a few times together. And something that is very evident every time that I speak with you is you've got a real passion for finance and for helping people. So I want to kick things off with your story. Can you share with us a bit about your background and how you got into the business of financial advice?
Yeah, sure. So I guess work-wise, I worked with one of the big banks. I actually started there straight after high school and was intended to be a short-term thing until I went to uni, but in the end, they kind of sponsored me through uni. So I did my degree part-time at night, and the bank supported me through that, which was fantastic. And so I ended up having 16 years at the bank, and the final seven of those was as a financial planner. But prior to that, I worked in several different roles, and one of them was an analyst-type role, which was sort of what I had thought I always wanted to get into. And then I did it for a year and actually found that looking at spreadsheets all day wasn't really what made me happy. And so I came to the realization that financial planning was really for me, I guess, in my late 20s. And that, as I say, that was after having done a few quite different roles, always within the financial field, but nevertheless, it was great to have that variety of experience. And I came to recognize that, look, I like the analytical stuff. I did like a spreadsheet, but I also liked a bit of human interaction and relationships. And I guess I'd always had an interest in investment markets. Even back in high school, I did work experience at a stockbroking firm, which was a hell of a lot of fun. It was back in the day where people still ran around and shouted on the stock exchange floor. And I got to be on the floor and run messages to our person that did the shouting. And so I'd always kind of had an interest there. And as I say, got into this role in the bank that I thought was my sort of role and then realized that it wasn't. And so a bit of self-reflection and identified that, look, financial planning, I think, is the sort of role that would be a great fit for me. And so, big organization, of course, lots of internal vacancies, that sort of stuff. So I remember the first opportunity I saw, I went for the job, and I remember telling the manager that was interviewing me that, look,
I've decided this is the role for me, and I'm just going to apply for every single one of these positions until you give one to me, you know. And by good fortune, it must have won him over, because you know, that very first one I applied for, I got. And so I learned quite a bit there, but eventually got to the point where I just felt working for, you know, for a product manufacturer, for a bank was conflicted, and it just wasn't sitting right with me. So left and went out on my own, and that was 2005. And yeah, sort of been, you know, running my own business since then. And, you know, that's been wonderful, of course, because then you can sort of really control the direction and yeah, focus on the things that interest you. So that's kind of roughly how I got.
Paul, we could begin the conversation in many places, but I think it makes sense to begin on the topic, the same topic that your book begins with. That's goal setting. So for listeners, why start here? Why is goal setting?
Yeah, the framework that we've got through the book, the starting point is goal setting. And I guess when you're trying to develop a strategy, you know, you've got to know what the ultimate destination is. Where are we trying to get to here? Because otherwise, you know, it's a bit like running around with the chook with its head cut off, I suppose. So yeah, goal setting is really important to determine where we're trying to get to, and then to work back from there as to what your strategy should be.
Paul, the thing about goal setting is it's not just about that goal or that destination. You can actually get a lot of enjoyment pursuing a goal too. I can remember, be it my time in football, it wasn't always about what may happen at the end of the season, but when you think back, the hard work that goes into achieving this goal, you can draw a lot of satisfaction from that.
Yeah, look, I think that's a great point, Ted. And yeah, I can understand totally. In your sporting career, you would have had plenty of experience there. So yeah, you're right. It's about the journey, isn't it? And in fact, there's a great description of happiness that I really like, which is that happiness is making progress towards a worthwhile goal. And I think that really encapsulates it well. So I guess that's another reason. If you don't have the goals to begin with, then you're not going to experience that journey and that happiness that comes with making that progress.
Paul, you ask questions about why you're pursuing a goal. And it made me think back to, I think it's Toyota that have got some rule where they ask why five times before they actually get to the fundamental way to solve a problem or the fundamental goal that they want to achieve. Why is that important, to kind of ask yourself why a goal is important?
Yeah, it's about digging down multiple layers, and certainly this isn't, yeah, not an original idea of mine. You're right. It's I think that Simon Sinek actually might have had this initially. Certainly, he's got some stuff on YouTube on it. But yeah, it's that idea of sort of digging down. So, like, if your goal is, I want to pay off the home loan, which is a totally viable financial goal, but why is that? Well, because then I don't have that obligation to meet those loan repayments every month, which takes a bit of pressure off. Okay, well, why is that? Well, because if I don't have that pressure, for one, I'm going to be happier. For two, I'm a bit more resilient if I lost my job or something like that. And three, maybe it gives me just a bit more flexibility, you know. And then you go, well, why is that important? Well, I don't know, you know, where you go from there, because maybe I'm not especially happy in my job and I want a career change. And, you know, so you've got your initial goal, I want to pay off my home loan, great, but you kind of get more, it gets more valuable the deeper you dig down. So to ask why multiple times can often really provide some good insights.
And it's important to dig down, and it's important to spend some time thinking about these things. But in saying that, somewhat goal setting is the easy bit, and prioritizing these goals, and you may have multiple goals that conflict, that can be the hard bit. And this leads to my next topic, and that is budgets. Why is a budget important?
Well, look, I mean, the fundamental to financial success is spending less than you earn. The reverse of that, of course, spending more than you earn, you're in a tailspin to financial disaster. So you just, really, we've set the goals, that's the starting point, but the very close second step is, well, all right, are we ensuring that there's some savings here? Our earnings exceed what we spend, and to the extent that we can maximize that, so much the better. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to live on beans and rice, of course. There's got to be a lifestyle balance to be had there, but certainly getting control of your cash flow is super important. And so some sort of budgeting strategy is really useful to do that. Now, the challenge is that most people, when they hear the word budget, it has negative connotations. It feels like it's all about constraint and, you know, oh, here's the fun police, you know. It's not a happy word, right? So we've got to turn that around, and that's why I tend to talk more about cash flow rather than budgeting to try and address that. The other thinking around referring to cash flow is budgeting kind of says it's all about the spending piece, which is certainly a significant portion. But of course, the other element is the income piece. I mean, if you are in a situation where your expenses exceed your income, well, the other solution to that is to try and get your income up, be it a second job or a promotion or something else. And right at the moment with COVID, that's probably extra challenging. But nevertheless, it's important to realize that there's two pieces to the puzzle. There's the amount of income coming in and the amount of money going out. And so you don't, you know, the focus doesn't have to be solely on the spending side. It could be on the income side too. So that's where cash flow maybe sort of picks up on those things and hopefully steps away a little bit from some of the negative feelings some people have about budgeting.
Yeah, there's a lot I want to speak to here, and you did touch on different strategies, and we'll speak to that shortly. But I do want to touch on debt, and if you've kind of identified debt is something that you have, and how, where that sits with a budget and potentially a goal.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the type of debt. So if it's debt, say it's your mortgage on your house, well, look, that's often really important in terms of your long-term financial security. And especially at the moment, interest rates are very low. So whilst paying off your home loan is something that you're going to want to do, it's not the case that everything else has to be on hold until that home loan's paid off. But that's quite different to, for instance, a credit card or some sort of debt that's associated with excess spending. You know, there you really would want to have the clearance of some of those lifestyle type debts. Clearing those is a bit of a priority before you moved on to investment and wealth creation and some of those other things typically. So it depends a bit on the debt and I guess what use the money's been put to.
I've read that there's some different theories that different people have in paying off debt. Many people have the view to pay down the highest interest rate first, and that makes sense. But there is also another view that some people have of paying off the smallest debt first and trying to get that sense of success and that momentum of success. And I was wondering what's your thoughts on those two different approaches?
Yeah, that idea is known as the debt snowball. And it is quite a good one. And I guess it's a bit of a balancing act. I mean, typically when I've looked at people's scenarios, you know, the bad debt will usually be credit card debt. Sometimes it's a personal loan. But if you look at the interest rates, it'll be the credit card that'll be the most expensive. And often people that are in debt trouble will have a few credit cards. Rarely do they just have one. But the interest rate will often be pretty similar across them, in which case, yeah, you probably would look at the smallest one first and go, right, let's focus on knocking that one over, because then we can free up the minimum repayments that we were paying on that, plus once that's all gone, and put all that money into then paying off the next credit card. So I think it is good to think about those, and yeah, it can be quite, I guess, you know, reinforcing quite positive sort of as a milestone to, oh, beauty, one credit card's gone. I can cut that one up and then we can move down to the second one. So yeah, it's a good way to think about it.
Paul, in this chapter, you also touch on the book, The Millionaire Next Door, which I found this fascinating. And it's all about households with assets greater than $1 million. And the fact that often these millionaire households would disproportionately clustered in blue collar and middle class suburbs, not in the affluent suburbs that many assume these millionaires live in. So can you, just for listeners, Paul, can you provide a bit of color as to kind of why that's the case?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's based on research. It's US based, of course, but I would imagine that it'd be pretty similar here in Australia, where, yeah, you would expect, I guess, there's certain suburbs where, you know, professionals and live and there's the flash cars on the street and this sort of stuff. And therefore you would assume that that's where the greatest wealth was. But actually what the research found is that a lot of people in those suburbs had a heck of a lot of debt as well, probably fueled by the fact that they had high incomes and therefore they felt confident that they could service that debt. But nevertheless, when you looked at their balance sheet, so when you netted off assets, you subtracted the amount of debt they had and then looked at, right, what's their net asset position? There was nowhere near as much wealth actually in those suburbs as there were in the more blue-collar type suburbs, where people tended to live less extravagantly. And consequently, you know, they had less debt. They didn't find the needs perhaps so much for the flashy car and these sort of things that often you borrow for, but, you know, the asset itself is depreciating. So as a financial transaction, it tends to be a pretty bad move. The research found that actually the stronger asset position, so the millionaires, were not the people that you assumed. They were often the more modest houses in the more, you know, middle ring kind of suburbs, who were just your everyday kind of people, but tended to pay off debt and get themselves in a stronger balance sheet position. So yeah, it was really interesting research, and certainly, you know, in my work with clients over 20 odd years, I've certainly seen that often. You know, the person driving the flash Audi, actually, when you look at their balance sheet, it's not very strong quite frequently, you know, even though they're trying to give the impression that, you know, they're killing it. But the more modest people often are in a stronger position.
Paul, I totally agree. This is like a macro study that looks at communities and society. But if you go very micro into my experience in football, I've seen the same thing in the locker room, where it's not the players that are on the high salaries that necessarily always leave the game in the best state. It's the people that are conscious of lifestyle creep and creeping into their spending patterns, and I guess what we call it is keeping up with the Joneses, is the ability to control your spending.
That would be really interesting in a football team, I'd imagine, where you would have, like in your experience, you've got a Goodsy or someone like that who presumably is on a really high income, and then you've got your first, second year players that are on a greatly different income, but you're all not that far apart in age. And yeah, I'd imagine there would be a bit of looking in the car park and who's got the flashiest car and that sort of stuff. I mean, how did you, assuming that you did, but how did you avoid that lifestyle creep?
With experience, I was better at it. So after 16 years of playing, I finished my career with a 1996 Toyota Corolla that was over 20 years old. And so I just had a short drive, and that's all I justify. And I copped a lot of crap for driving it. There's all sorts of players in the game, from those that are very frugal with their spending, somewhat too frugal. But to those that... that really don't have a great awareness that we only play the game for a finite period of time, and they drop far too much money on holidays and clothes and things like that. And it's sad that they haven't made the decisions to be able to you know, set themselves up for later in life. So, but this is a very small example of what happens in the community too, though.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that getting back to the millionaire next door, that's why the financial position isn't as strong in the suburbs that look like they would be affluent, because there's a lot of keep up with the Joneses. You know, if the next door neighbor's got the new Land Rover, well, you know, you might feel under pressure that you can't have the old Ford Falcon in the driveway, you know? And so, yeah, it's replicated just through the community, isn't it?
Now, we did start talking about budgets, and there's a couple of different strategies within the book that you touch on. Different types of budgets. I think there might even be six here. So, Paul, I don't want to go through in detail that the book goes into it with all these different strategies, which is fantastic. So maybe if we just spend just a couple of sentences on each of these budgets and very quickly how they work. So let's start off with the 50-20-30 method.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. Well, perhaps if you don't mind, before we jump into the specific methods, just to explain to the listeners, because it's a really central part of my thinking and the book, and that is that there's no one right way. And I just felt that looking at other finance type books and other content that goes around, that too often there's some sort of guru who says, look, this is the way, and you must do it my way. And if you don't do it my way, well, you're just wrong and you're going to fail and whatever. And I just think, having worked with clients for 20 years, I know that to be incorrect. There are all different ways to financial success. And so through the book, we look at lots of different options. Now, one of them is, as you say, these cash flow budget strategies. And so what we have is six different cash flow strategies. And I've got a self-assessment tool. So people can kind of just a series of questions and people can answer them. And then that points you to, right, here's the budgeting strategy we think is most likely to work for you. And we've got a plan B as well. So the intent with having six is not to kind of overwhelm people, but rather just to recognize the fact that, look, you've got your engineer type that loves their spreadsheet and wants to track every single dollar. And then you've got normal people who wouldn't want to do anything like that. And so we're trying to have these range of options so that people can find a strategy that's going to work for them, right? So that's why there are six, because people might go, man, just pick one, you know? But anyway, that's the rationale, right? So
before we get into it, I've got to speak about this. Gurus online that say this is how you do it. I hate those. So I'm so rapt that you did mention that, because be it not just finance, but they're talking about diet. It really f***s me when I hear people talk about this is how it has to be.
Yeah. Well, I'm exactly the same. And as I say, I hope, because like what I've put together in this book and the framework and stuff I put together, it comes from working with people for 20 years. So, and I think that's where the gurus get it wrong, is they're just like, well, this is what I did and it worked for me, so it should work for everybody, you know, and it's just not right. So hopefully what we've put together here is useful to people, because it's come about through actually observing hundreds of people and what's worked for them. So anyhow, in terms of those strategies, yeah, as you said, there's six. So there's the 50-20-30 method, which is a method of simply breaking up your income into predetermined portions. So 50% is for living costs, 20% for long-term savings, and 30% for bills. So that's a nice one to just bang, you can get started immediately, no great analysis, implement, right? There's the bucket strategy, which is probably the most popular of all strategies. And that one, it's quite similar to that 50-20-30, but in this case, you actually go back and look at your bank statement, say for the last 3 months or 6 months, look at where you're spending your money, and then determine, all right, I need to put X amount into the bills each fortnight. I'll put a certain amount into a savings account for holidays and that sort of stuff, and leave the rest for spending. So quite similar to the 50-20-30, but requires you to crunch your numbers. Reverse budget is another really simple one to implement. And that's where you simply say, well, all right, what I'm going to do is, as soon as I get paid, I'm going to save X amount. So it's $500 or whatever the figure is. And then I'll just live off the rest. So no need to track how much you spend on a coffee, which most people don't want to do. But you've ensured that before you do anything else, you saves. That's the idea of reverse. I guess traditionally people who don't have a budget think, oh, well, I'll just spend across the fortnight, and whatever's left at the end of the fortnight, that's what I'll save. And of course, rarely is there anything left at the end of the fortnight. So the idea with reverse, save first, then spend. The big cut strategy is a really interesting one. And this is most useful for people where their expenses are maybe over their income, or at least getting close. And that is to look at your expenses and order them in terms of, right, the thing I spend the most amount of money on is maybe getting a roof over your head, and then the next one, and you order them, and you focus probably on the top five or so of your expenses, the biggest outlays that you have, and you try and find one of those that you can cut out, and it's just one big cut. So the idea is that you find something that's a bit painful, a little bit uncomfortable, but it is only one thing. So it might be, perhaps in a family household, perhaps it's cutting out one car, or it could be, if you're renting, maybe it's, look, we're going to move to somewhere cheaper or somewhere smaller. It's finding one thing that's a significant regular expense, cutting that out, and then in that way, bringing your finances into better shape and moving forward. Number five is track your spending approach, which is one where at the end of each month, this is probably more like a business would typically do. At the end of each month, you do some analysis through a spreadsheet or using an app or something like that. But you look at, right, well, how did we spend our money over the last month? And are we happy with how we spent it? Gee, we spent quite a bit on takeaway last month. You know, maybe for the month ahead, we'll try and do a bit better on that. So it's not putting any constraints on you, but it's just getting you to actually have a look and a think and a bit of reflection as to whether you're happy with how you're using your money. And then the final one is the most hardcore one, and probably, to be honest, what people think about when they think of a budget, which is the zero-based budget. And that's where you do actually start of every month, right, here's what I'm going to allocate, X amount for the groceries, X amount for the phone, this much for the internet, you know, really break it down. And then at the end of the month, check that you've kept on track there and you haven't overspent. In truth, very few people use this strategy, but for people that are struggling a bit financially, you know, things are a bit tight, then the zero-based one can be quite useful. Generally, it's not sustainable, but even if you do it for 3 months or 6 months and that's enough to kind of get your spending lined up better with your income, then it still has value. And then potentially you move to something that's a bit easier to work with, you know, going forward.
Well, yeah, a question I had is, how common is it for people to change their budget strategies as you're going through those? It seems like the reverse budget is probably the easiest in terms of just paying yourself first, some figure. But once again, with a bit of momentum, you may look at taking that a next step and taking into like the bucket strategy or the 50-20-30. Do you see that those strategies happens where people can actually change their types of budget?
Yep. Yeah. And encourage it too. Like, you know, get in there, use a strategy to get you started, because that's the biggest issue with most things for us in life is making a start, but then definitely tweak it, fine tune it. Like the 50-20-30, really, that's just a way of you stop procrastinating, right? Do something 50-20-30, but you might run with it for a couple of months and realize that actually for me, it needs to be 60, you know, 10, 30, whatever. Yeah. So by all means, adjust it. And then some of these will start to merge and you make it to be what works for you. But it's trying to give you that stepping off point.
Okay. So you've done your goal setting, you've got some form of budget operating successfully, mm-hmm. and now you've got money left over and not sure what to do with it. Most commonly, for the sake of this discussion, let's focus in on stocks and property. There's a lot of different ways that we can start off here, but I do want to speak with you, Paul, about your thoughts on investing with exchange-traded funds, more commonly known as ETFs.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I guess a caveat, not giving advice here, all right? Yeah, general information, which obviously you'll cover off at the start.
Yes.
But yeah, look, exchange-traded funds, something that we use a lot. Obviously, I know you guys use a lot there at Six Park, and we love what you guys do at Six Park. ETFs are a really good way to gain diversification. They're a really cost-effective way to get access to different themes and different markets. So, for instance, if you wanted to get exposure to the US share market, which of course is the biggest market in the world, over half of all the world share market is in the US. So most investors would want some exposure to that. Well, it's pretty cost effective for you to buy an ETF that covers that market, perhaps the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or something along those lines. And you can gain that broad exposure to the US market in a single trade with very, very low management costs. Similarly, you know, different themes. So for instance, global healthcare is a popular theme. I mean, there's the pandemic just at the moment, but there's also just a theme around aging population in the Western world. So you could buy an ETF that covers global healthcare, for instance, and get exposure there. Whereas the alternative for you would be to try and research a whole lot of different medical companies all around the world and pick which ones you think are best. And certainly I couldn't do that, Ted, and I don't know how you feel on that, but it'd be pretty challenging. So ETFs are a really good way to get diversification. They're really cost effective. And I guess probably even just to take a slight step back, but when you're investing in stocks, your objective is to get the return, get the average return over time of what you would expect the market to deliver, which historically has been probably 8 to 10%. Maybe it'll be a little lower in the future for a variety of reasons we can talk about later. But you're trying to achieve that because the alternative is you leave your money in cash and you're lucky to keep pace with inflation. You're not investing in stocks as sort of a gambling proposition. You're trying to get a reliable outcome and then that gets you towards your goal. And so being appropriately diversified helps ensure that you get the outcome that you expect. That's where ETFs are a really useful tool for that sort of goal.
And Paul, I'm interested when you speak with clients at Guidance, how much of the discussion is focused in on the behavioural and the psychological aspect that comes from investing compared to what most people might think is discussions purely around underlying investments and then fundamental things that are influencing that business?
It's funny, you know, I think that's, they tend to be discussions you have with clients over time, because yep. at the initial engagement, you can talk about, hey, look, at some point we're going to have negative returns in this portfolio. That's normal, and it doesn't mean the strategy's wrong. And people can nod their head and say that's fine, but it's not until they actually see that on their statement that you really get a test of whether they've really bought into that or they've really appreciated that that's the truth. It also, it's a lot easier if your first negative return comes after three really good years, whereas it's quite difficult if your first negative return happens to be the first year that you invested. It's pretty natural to then think, gee, have I made the wrong call here? Have I got the wrong strategy? Those sort of things. So I guess, yeah, that behavioral stuff in my experience more comes about, you know, like typically with clients, we catch up for a formal progress meeting once a year. So it tends to come about as we go through those progress meetings. And of course we have discussions over the course of the year too, but it's particularly those ones where, well, look, here's what happened over the last 12 months. And it's pretty relevant just at the moment, because obviously share markets had a big drop there in March due to COVID. And so a lot of people are looking at their statements and there might be negative returns or only just in the positive territory. To sort of talk through that. And some people will be like, yeah, that's totally fine. I've seen this before, GFC, for instance. I know we're going to get strong bounce back. There's total logic as to why the market might have pulled back a bit as it did in March. And, you know, so some people are totally fine. Yeah, that's all part of the journey, no problem. But yeah, you do get other people that are like, well, gee, we've got to change something. Something must be wrong. And yeah, so that's a challenge. Everyone's different. And that, frankly, is part of what makes the job interesting.
Yeah, it's so important to get someone's risk profile right when they're invested, so they can pass that sleep test and sleep well at night. Because as you mentioned there, Paul, if corrections do happen, I think on average most years crashes do happen, whatever it is. So you will be tested, and the worst possible outcome is that you sell out when things are low. So yeah, just ensuring that you've got that risk profile right for your investments is so important. So we could speak about stocks for ages, and Paul, it's an area of interest of mine, and I love it. So as much as I'd like to, but I'd also like to move across to property, which is something that Australians are very passionate about, possibly too much sometimes. Paul, can you tell me your thoughts on property compared to stocks?
Yeah, look, thanks, Ted. Yeah, I guess the first thing to say on that, again, you know, talking back to the fact that there's no one right way, it's similar with stocks and with property. My experience is that very often people feel that they have to, you know, like picking a football team, right? Once you declare, right, this is the team I'm barracking for, or mum and dad's decided, well, you're not allowed to change. And so people have the same thing. Either, you know, they're a property investor and I'd be betraying the fraternity if I happened to buy some stocks, or vice versa. That's wrong. I mean, look, by all means, property only, I totally get if you're a builder or if you're handy, right? Because you can add a lot of value to a property. And so that makes a heck of a lot of sense. But even then, I mean, I've got one client who is a builder and has done really well out of property, but he still has a really significant share portfolio too. So I just want to encourage listeners to recognize that you don't have to be one or the other. It's totally fine to have both, and they each have their pros and their cons. Stocks, of course, far more liquid. They don't have all the transaction costs and stamp duties and that sort of stuff, but they do have volatility. Property is lovely because you can leverage into it. You can gear quite easily. Banks are happy to lend. So then you get the leveraged effect. A relatively small increase in the value of the property can be a large increase in the value of your holding as a result of the leveraged impact of the borrowings. Property is also quite nice because it typically gives pretty regular cash flow. Occasionally you have vacancies or a problem tenant, but for the most part, it tends to provide pretty reliable cash flow. So property and stocks, they each have their roles. They each have their relevancy. And I think it's really good for people to be open to both. and not sort of feel that they have to pick a side.
Yeah, it's a good point. The other thing that I've noticed with property is a lot of people will look at the selling price that someone sold for and minus the buying price and assume that that difference, and often with property it might be a large difference, is net profit. But there's a lot of costs that come into that for, you know, servicing the mortgage, maintenance, transaction costs, even stamp duty, which is can be massive. They all need to be netted out too.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, properties wear out, don't they? And you don't get that with stocks. So, yep, dead right. And yeah, you do see the numbers, the newspaper and things, as you touch on, and I talk about that in the book actually. But yeah, you know, someone buys a place for $500,000 and they sell it for $1 million, and the newspaper will suggest, oh, they made a $500,000 profit, but it fails to mention the fact that they spent $600,000 on renovations or something. You know, so yeah, the property numbers are a problem. And I guess that's just a bit of an awareness issue.
Yeah, Paul, it's an interesting time right now with interest rates as low as they are and people entering into the property market right now, possibly signing up for 25, 30-year mortgages, is determining how much they can borrow and what they can service, considering mean reversion and interest rates may, who knows what the future might look like, start to increase at some stage. So I was wondering your thoughts on what you tell people in terms of their ability to service a mortgage going forward.
Yeah, look, I think legitimate concern there. Yeah, interest rates are very low at the moment. You'd think that at some point they might go up. I mean, the Federal Reserve in the US, which, as much as they don't set rates in Australia, they drive the global tone and it flows through everywhere else. You know, they've indicated that rates will be low for a very long time and that they'd rather see a bit of inflation than higher interest rates. So all the indications are, and there's no certainty, but all the indications are we're going to see low rates for a while, but you would still expect that at some point, especially if central banks can create a bit of inflation, then at some point interest rates will need to go up to sort of keep pace with that and maybe even keep a bit of a lid on inflation one day. So I guess it would be prudent for people when they're taking out loans to, I guess, at least do the numbers, assuming that rates are, say, 1.5% higher than they're actually being charged, and try and make repayments at that level so that then you're getting a bit ahead in terms of your loan and you know you can afford and withstand some degree of rising interest rates. For interest rates to go up, they're only going to go up probably if we get absolute boom times and in particular see some inflation. And you would hope that in that environment, you'd also see wages rise, at least to keep pace with inflation. So it shouldn't be too much of an issue because, sure, your home loan repayments might go up, but your pay should go up too. No guarantees on that. But I don't think you need to be so conservative as, well, all right, I've got to assume that rates might be double or triple what they are today, and unless I can do that, I can't afford to buy a home kind of thing. To me, that's too extreme, but I think maybe just doing your numbers with it 1% higher, 1.5% higher, something like that would just give you that bit of safety margin.
Yeah, it's interesting, and we do hear of stories for those that aren't old enough of where interest rates were in the late 80s. I believe they get up to 17 or 18%. So historical point of view, it's incredible to where we are right now compared to where we were at that time.
Yeah, but it also informs why share prices are quite a bit different now too. You know, it does, and property prices for that matter. The low interest rates mean that you can afford to pay a lot more for assets because they don't cost as much to hold. So yeah, interest rates were a lot higher back then, but houses cost a lot less then too, and mortgages are a lot smaller then too.
Paul, there's other parts of your book which we haven't had time to go into, which I'd love to, but we'll save that for another time because there's many other things that I'd love to focus in on. So I think the book also touches on side hustles, so make sure if that's an area of interest for you that you get the book, and there's also further information on the topics that we've already discussed. But I want to, as I said, I want to speak about some other parts of your life outside of this book. You're also a financial advisor. Somewhere around 20% or so of Australians have been to a financial advisor. So for the 80%, 70%, whatever it is, that might not be familiar with a financial advisor, what does that entail?
Yeah, so I guess going through a little bit of what we've talked about today, first and foremost, it's goal setting and clarity around goals and what we're trying to get to. Then we'd go through understanding your personal balance sheet, your tolerance towards risk, your previous investment experience, some of those type of things. And then it's about creating a strategy to help you make progress towards those particular goals. And usually there's an ongoing ongoing relationship that you have there with a financial planner. Doesn't have to be the case, but most often that's the way it's effective. And the relationship is typically useful because people find it helpful to have, someone to bounce things off and to maybe save them a bit from themselves. Because if you do have, let's say, share markets dive, as I say, we saw a big drop in March there with COVID. If you've got no one to talk to, then the inclination might be, this is all a bit scary. I better sell everything and switch it all to cash. But if you've got someone that you can speak to and say, hey, I'm a bit nervous about this. What's going on? Is the world coming to an end? And they can provide a bit of context and say, hey, look, yep, it is a bit ugly. It's not much fun when markets go down, but we've seen this before. And here's the way these things tend to play out. And every drop's unique in its own way, but nevertheless, there's still some commonalities. Having someone to sort of talk through, to talk about, well, look, here's the objectives. The reality is we've had a few good years prior. Trying to just sort of talk you off the ledge, I suppose. I think people often find really valuable. And to the same extent, when things are booming, to maybe just, well, maybe we don't go and borrow that excessive amount of money and plonk it all in Afterpay shares or something, So yeah. Just having that sounding board, having that relationship, I think a lot of people like the peace of mind of just knowing, I don't have to worry too much about that because I know my financial planner's got it covered. It gives people a lot of peace of mind. And I guess your financial life, I mean, the structure that we've got now with superannuation and I guess weaning people off a government age pension means that the expectation is we're going to take responsibility and control of our own financial lives. And so for a lot of people, that's not their core competency or something that they enjoy doing. So partnering with a planner that they can work with can often be really useful for them, liberating and really help them achieve the goals that they want and get the freedom that they're looking for.
Paul, you've also chosen to partner with a robo-advisor, and full disclosure, that Sixpark, the business I'm involved in, I'm just interested, how do you see the benefits of digital or robo-advice working side by side with a human advisor like yourself?
Yeah, look, it's great to be working with you guys at Sixpark. I think something that we identified is that sometimes we have people come to us who want to get started, particularly with an investment. It might be 20,000, could be even less, but their need is not complicated enough to justify us doing a full planning process and the costs associated with that, quite frankly. So we needed a way that we could help them at a lower cost point, but still do it in a robust quality way. And I guess what attracted me to what you guys are doing at Sixpark is that you're not a fund manager. So you're not conflicted there, that you guys can put together portfolios for clients that have a mix of different product manufacturers sitting underneath that you guys have done your research and determined which are going to get the best job done for the clients at the best possible price. So I liked that fact. And I think that that robo digital advice solution, I think, is a really nice complement to financial planning, one-on-one advice. As I say, particularly for people maybe with simpler needs, just to give a quality solution that enables them to move forward with their goals. And I guess the hope is that in some cases, they might start with that and then build up some wealth, and the work that Sixpark does gets them into some good habits and delivers some good outcomes. And then there might be appropriate for then personalized one-on-one advice a few years down the road where we can dig into some other strategies. So in some cases, it might be a really good stepping stone as well. It's still early days to sort of see if that is what happens, but that's the hope. So really excited with working with you guys at Sixpark.
Yeah, and we've spoken about in the US, this is more widely known, these two services working side by side, where the likes of Ritholtz Wealth Management partnering with Betterment, two fantastic businesses, each solving somewhat different problems in the same industry, but just different ways, one tech, one more traditional face-to-face, and examples of how technology can complement the important service that a human advisor can provide.
Absolutely.
So now, Paul, before we wrap it up, you've written a book, which I've never done, and I hear is incredibly hard work, and you also do a podcast each week. And to be fair, I've never done that. I do one podcast a month. So I'm fascinated, Paul. What's harder, the podcast each week or writing a book?
They're kind of quite different. Writing a book is a bit like sitting down to a big roast dinner, right? It's a big undertaking, but it's kind of one concentrated big thing. Whereas a weekly podcast is kind of more like going out for a coffee. You know, it's short grabs, but you got to do a lot of it. So they're really different.
What do you enjoy more?
I really enjoy them both, to be honest with you, Ted. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the book process. I mean, look, the back and forth editing is not heaps of fun in the book process, but it's important so that you get a good quality book at the end. And I'm glad to have worked with a good editor who really helped me there. So yeah, look, I enjoyed the book. Fortunately, about, I don't know, 2/3 of the book thereabouts, I did actually over the summer break last year. We sort of weren't going away on holidays that year. And so I just spent, varied a bit, but four to six hours, you know, just each morning, get up early, everyone else is still in bed and work on it. And so that was really good because I got sort of uninterrupted time and I could really rip into it. Once the office reopened and I was back at work, it obviously slowed it down quite a bit from there. So I really enjoyed that, just to have that time. And I think if ever I wrote a book again, I'd be inclined to, go away for a couple of weeks or longer or whatever. And just, that dedicated time was really helpful. So I enjoy them both anyway. Long-winded answer.
No. It's fascinating. So the book Financial Autonomy is available from all bookshops, including digital online ones. So I think it's even available on Kindles too. And that's how I like reading, because you can underline at the end, you can just download everything you've underlined. But I'm not here to sell Kindles.
you're right, Ted. Yeah, so it's available everywhere. But just worth a mention, if people, if they do want a hard copy, if they order it direct from us, then it's free postage within Australia. So just if people wanted to avail themselves of that. So that's at financialautonomy.com.au/book. You can access it there, and it's free postage. But by all means, if you want to support your local bookshop, if you prefer a digital copy or something like that, then you can source it, wherever good books are sold, I think is the normal way they phrase it, isn't it, Ted?
Yeah, and your podcast, Financial Autonomy of the same name, is available where all good podcasts are available. So now, Paul, you've also got guidance. So where can listeners, if they'd like to find out more information about your business, Guidance Financial Services, where can they find you there?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, look, if you Google Guidance Financial Services, you'll find out about us there too. Although if you go to the Financial Autonomy website, that has our Financial Autonomy program, which talks about the advice that we provide through guidance as well. So either of those you could check out and you'll find out more about us.
Yeah, and you've got some great educational content that's available on that Financial Autonomy website. You must have put in a lot of work, because it's some good content there.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we've been doing the podcast for 3 years, and a lot of the podcast are effectively like they're blog posts that I've written, and then I've converted them into an audio. So it's roughly, the podcast is roughly 50-50. Half of them are interviews and half of them are just single voice, me sort of running through a particular idea or concept. And so particularly those single voice ones, that they obviously lend themselves to a written format as well. So yeah, we have a lot of those and downloadable check sheets and bits and pieces to kind of help people make progress on their goals. So yeah, so thanks for noticing that. Yeah, we have built up quite a lot of useful content. So hopefully people can dive in there and it helps them.
Well, it's an important life skill. So if you can arm yourselves with some great education to be able to make important financial decisions, it'll hold you in good stead for later in life. So I might wrap it up there. Paul, thank you very much for chatting on the Richards Report.
Wonderful. Thanks for inviting me along, Ted.